Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We continue with Ask Me Anything on Catholic Answers Live, and you should know that is open to anybody. Anybody can call if you've got a question. Certainly any question about the Catholic faith is welcome, but when Jimmy's here, Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour, anything's welcome. You got something you'd like to know about, you'd like to talk about with Jimmy, you are welcome to call 888-318-7884. And I know I made that sound really encouraging, but now I have to follow that up with all the lines are full at the moment. So call throughout the hour. Lines do open up, of course, periodically, but we'd love to get you on the air with Jimmy. We just need to get a line open to do that. 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin, as I said last hour, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World and the new podcast, the Jimmy Akin Podcast, among many other things. Check out, if you go to YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts, search Jimmy Akin Podcast and you can find the new one. Jimmy, ready for another hour?
Oh, sure.
All right. Because as I was saying, lines are so, we had one line open for like, I don't know, 20 seconds last hour. Other than that, they just continue full. Let's just go right back to the phones then. Ken's in Omaha, Nebraska, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. Glad you're here, Ken. Go ahead with your question.
Hi. The reason I'm calling is something that's been on my mind lately. Mm-hmm.
What's that?
I was wondering why Judas was necessary as far as betraying Jesus. I mean, think about it from at least in my thoughts. Jesus was really famous around the time. And then I could see where they needed Judas to take him to Gethsemane. But I don't understand why Judas had to point him out at that point. Because you'd think when they got to Gethsemane, they'd say, yeah, that's him over there, yeah. And I'm just wondering why Judas was needed to point Jesus out to people who I would think would know what he looks like.
Okay, well, strictly speaking, Judas was not necessary, but, you know, God could have done this some other way. But God chose to use Judas in this situation, and the Catechism says that in the predestination of Jesus to go to the cross, God incorporated the free will choices of the people who were involved. And so that included Judas and the Jewish authorities and the guards that were sent to arrest Jesus. Now, one of the things about Jerusalem at the time of Passover is it had an absolutely enormous population. Because of all the pilgrims who came. This was one of the three annual pilgrimage feasts where observant Jews were expected to come to Jerusalem for this. And so some in the Jewish diaspora in foreign lands couldn't make it, but a lot of them did anyway come. And so you had all of the Jews from, you know, Israel, from Judea and Galilee and so forth. They were coming, as well as loads of Jews from foreign lands. And Luke talks about that in Acts chapter 2. He gives us a list of where people were coming from. And we know from other sources, like the Jewish historian Josephus, that the city's population just jumped hugely at Passover to like 1.5 million people, which is amazing, if I remember the number correctly, which is like amazingly huge for any ancient city. And that means that there, it was hard to find people if you didn't know where they were going to be. And it also means there were a lot of people who looked alike, especially in the dark. And so it, the Jewish authorities, as Jesus himself points out, could have taken him when he was out publicly teaching during the day. But the Gospels tell us they didn't want to do that because they were afraid if they did that, it could provoke a riot among the people because the people regarded him as a prophet. So they didn't want to take him openly. They wanted to take him in private when there weren't a lot of people around. And that means they would need to know where he would be, not during the day, but at night. And that's hard when you've got a huge number of pilgrims who are all divvying up to go eat the Passover at different places. And so they needed Judas to guide them to where Jesus would be on the night of betrayal, which was Passover. And Judas knew where he had learned where Jesus was going to eat the Passover. But there's a very interesting thing in the Gospels where in the three synoptic Gospels, Jesus doesn't let the disciples know where that's going to be until the last minute. He's apparently arranged it on his own. He's made arrangements to eat the Passover at a particular guy's house, but he doesn't tell the disciples until they have killed the Passover lamb. And then they say, well, where do you want us to eat the Passover? And he sends two of the disciples, Peter and John, Luke tells us. He says, go into the city. You'll find a guy carrying a water jug on his head, which is unusual because fetching water was women's work at the time. And you'll find this guy doing it. Follow him. And when he goes into a house, ask the householder, not the guy with the jug, ask the householder, where is the room for me to eat the Passover meal with my disciples? And so what this has the effect of is not even the disciples know where they're going to eat the Passover until the last minute. And the apparent reason for that is Jesus really wants to eat this Passover with the disciples. He says as much, I've greatly desired to eat this Passover with you. And he institutes the Eucharist. And because the disciples didn't know until the last minute where they were going to be eating it, Judas had no opportunity to go off and betray him and say, here's where he's going to eat the Passover. You can bust in while he's doing that and arrest him. And so Judas has to, from the dinner, he knows they're going to go to the Garden of Gethsemane afterwards. And so during the dinner, Judas leaves to say, hey, he's going to be at the Garden of Gethsemane like he usually goes to. He's going to be there after the dinner, and you can arrest him then. And he says, whoever I kiss is going to be the guy. Well, so then they send with Judas an armed squad to arrest Jesus, and maybe some of the armed squad recognized him, but this is in the dark and they're doing stuff by torchlight and moonlight. And so it can be hard to recognize someone if you don't actually know that person, if all you've got is torches and moonlight. And so that it thus makes sense for Judas to go up and kiss Jesus, which was a common greeting at the time, so that the guards who he brought there would know which one of the people in the garden is actually Jesus. They don't want to arrest the wrong guy, which you might do if you're dealing with someone you don't really know personally and it's dark and all you've got is torchlight and moonlight.
Ken, what a great question to get us started this hour. Thanks so much. We've got to take a quick break. Right back with more Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at magnificat.com.
EWTN Radio Essentials is now EWTN Radio Extra. It's the past, present, and future of Catholic radio. You'll hear classic programs from Mother Angelica and Dr. Scott Hahn, plus timeless devotionals and award-winning podcasts from our partners on EWTN's Podcast Central. Listen now to EWTN Radio Extra on the EWTN app, on smart speakers, and on EWTN.com.
Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour on Catholic Answers Live. Your calls, welcome. But lots of folks on the line right now, so we're just going to keep Jimmy working. We'll just keep him working throughout the whole hour. Here's John Paul in Berkeley, California, watching on YouTube. John Paul, thank you for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hello, thank you very much. I want to start by saying that I am Catholic, and I'm actually writing a book about the permissibility of abortion, against the permissibility of abortion. Okay. I'm actually going to ask quite a loaded question here, so please bear with me for a second.
Just keep it clean.
I'm familiar with the violinist argument.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm going to bring up like a sort of variation of this argument. So first we assume that the child in the womb is a person just as much as any adult human being. And then we can imagine a mother and her 8-year-old child in a scenario where the 8-year-old child has a kidney ailment such that he needs someone else's kidney to survive. The mother is the only person with a kidney that would suffice to save the child's life. Does the mother have a moral obligation to donate her kidney? Now, this isn't my question, but what I wanted to bring up is that one common response that I hear to this question is that it is not morally obligatory because the mother's kidney is for her, but her uterus is for the natural purpose of fostering children. However, I'm not quite sure that this response is sufficient in showing that abortion is impermissible, as it seems to commit the appeal to nature fallacy, which is to say just because something is within nature does not make it right. Viruses are obviously not a good thing, but they are within nature. And under this logic, would it then
except
be impermissible
for the good
to
viruses.
Say, like,
there
under
are
this logic,
good ones.
Would it then be impermissible for a man to say, for him to blind himself or cover his ears or walk with his hands? It seems that it's not simply enough to say that the purpose of the uterus is for fostering of children. To show that abortion is impermissible, you'd have to show why that would make abortion impermissible. So then my question is, why is the uterus being for the purpose of fostering children enough to say abortion is impermissible?
Well, I don't think that saying the uterus is for purposes of fostering children is the reason abortion is wrong. The reason abortion is wrong is it's killing an innocent human being. And that's the fundamental reason abortion is wrong. I, in my own apologetics, I never appeal to the purpose of the uterus with respect to abortion.
Okay, but in the example where the child needs the kidney to survive, not giving the kidney would essentially be, you know, would essentially mean that you're letting the child die. And most people would seem to say that it's not morally obligatory to do this. So it would seem that you're saying that the uterus being for the purpose of fostering children is not a reason for why abortion is impermissible, or at least is not a response to this. What would your response then be?
Yeah, so I should mention what the argument you're basing this on is for people who may not be aware. There was a paper that was written in 1971 by a philosopher named Judith Jarvis Thompson, who I've actually met, called A Defense of Abortion. And in it, she has a thought experiment where a famous violinist is hooked up to someone against that person's will who has a kidney that the violinist needs to use in order to survive. And they're a very valuable person because they're such a famous violinist. And the question is the woman within her moral rights to disconnect the violinist rather than be inconvenienced by having this violinist hooked up to her? If I understand your parallel argument correctly, it's a mother who needs to donate a kidney to one of her own children. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. I would say all things being equal, so, you know, they can afford it and it's not going to cause worse health problems, I would say the mother is obliged to donate her kidney to her child, even if she's the only one. I would say if I was a mother and I have two good kidneys and I can survive with one of them and my child is going to die without one of them and I can save my child by giving him a kidney, I'm going to give him the kidney and I'm going to feel like that's a moral duty I have. all things being equal, that we can afford it. There's not some competing problem that this situation is going to generate. As if I can donate a kidney and not be seriously inconvenienced myself and save the life of my child, I'm going to say, heck yeah, I'm morally obliged to save the life of my child.
All right, thank you for the response. So on that note, I would follow up by saying, should we create a law then that would enforce this principle?
Well, so in this case, I'd have to think about that. My inclination is to say no, but the situations are disanalogous. In the first case, the case of the donating the kidney, you would be requiring someone to take a positive action to save the life of their child. And in the second case, you're directly killing the child in the abortion case. So I would say it's easier to see why there should be a law against directly killing someone compared to a law compelling positive moral action.
John Paul, going to leave it there because, as I've said, the lines are full. So on we go. Good luck with the book. I hope that goes well. And John is in Oregon watching on YouTube. John, thank you for the call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, Jimmy. How are you doing?
Howdy. I'm doing fine.
Good. My question is about this notion that's kind of showing up in a lot of non-denominational circles, at least in this area. I don't know about other places in the country, but at least here in Oregon. And it's been brought up a lot about a one world order or one world religion, and the Pope is supposedly behind it all and is going to be the head of it, and it's going to have its own currency, and it's supposed to in some way usher in the end times. I've heard this from people who are, you know, post-trib rapture people, pre-trib, even mid-trib people say the same thing. I'm wondering if you've heard of anything about this, and where does it come from, and kind of what is the Catholic, can I say, in defense of it, especially like in defense of the Pope? I mean, I know about how to defend against people that say that the Pope is the Antichrist. Like, that's a pretty easy thing to just prove. But this one world religion thing, where I'm not sure where it came from, and, you know, to kind of learn how to defend against it, you have to learn where it comes from and what they actually believe or where the origin's from.
So the answer is that this comes from the Book of Revelation, and it's from their reading of the Book of Revelation, because it says in Revelation that there are going to be these two great beasts. They're introduced, for example, in Revelation 13. One of them, the beast from the sea, is basically a world ruler that persecutes Christians, and it has a mark, which is 666. And then the second beast, which it says has two horns like a lamb, compels the people of the world to worship the beast and take its mark, everybody except the Christians. And so people coming from a dispensationalist premillennial background will say this part of the Book of Revelation applies to our future, and so the beast from the sea and the beast from the land, the one that has the two horns like a lamb, they're future figures, and this is going to apply to the whole world. And so if everyone in the world except Christians is going to worship the beast, then that must result in a one world religion. And so how could a one-world religion happen? Well, it would obviously have to have the involvement of the Pope, they would argue, because he's a major world religious leader. Some of them, who might say that the Pope himself is the Antichrist, would see the Pope as the head of this, both the government and the religion, because they believe there's going to be a one-world government because of the beast from the land, and a one-world religion because the beast from the sea, and a one-world religion because of the beast from the land. And so if those who would identify the Pope as the Antichrist would say he's the beast from the sea. Not everybody in the Protestant world says that, though, or even the dispensational premillennial part of the Protestant world. The more common view is that the Pope may be a candidate to be the beast from the land who will encourage people to worship the Antichrist. But nevertheless, because he's a prominent religious leader, he must be involved in this somehow. And so he would play a role in encouraging religions to merge as part of a setup for the eventual introduction of this one world religion. And maybe the Pope will even be the head of it. That's where this comes from. All of that is nonsense. In the first place, just to point out something that gets neglected by the people who spin these kind of theories, how do you know the Pope is going to agree to any of this? The Pope is, he may encourage religious, you know, people of different religions to dialogue with each other and to get along and to not cause wars, but the Pope is the representative of Jesus Christ. If Jesus isn't the way, the truth, and the life, the Pope has no job. And so, you know, if any Pope who's a genuine Christian is given the proposition, let's start worshiping a world leader as God, he's going to say, heck no. And if he's driven underground and martyred, like the early popes were, who actually confronted emperor worship, he would do that. So the idea the Pope's just going to go along with this is nonsense. The Pope is going to, it would be willing to accept martyrdom rather than go along with this, just as has been illustrated by numerous previous popes when the Roman Empire was trying to enforce emperor worship. Okay, that leads to our second point. This part of the book of Revelation does not refer to our future. It refers to the early centuries. Specifically, it refers to the period before the Roman Empire had converted. And the beast from the sea is a representation of the line of Roman emperors, and the mark of the beast is accepting emperor worship. Now, I can make those assertions in a short space. I can't argue for all of them in a short space. But if you go to my YouTube channel, youtube.com/Jimmy Akin, and you look up Mark of the Beast, you'll find several resources I have there that talk about this in more detail. I also have some 20 answers, little books that deal with the book of Revelation and how it's to be interpreted, as well as other passages of biblical prophecy. And you could check those out for more information as well, to get the evidence that supports the views I just articulated.
John, thank you. I'm moving quickly between calls just because there are so many of them today. David is in Michigan listening on 990 AM. David, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, it's a pleasure. I've been listening for about an hour now on the radio, mm-hmm. and I heard you talk about Dan Brown and how you don't like his works. I was curious, someone that finds the Da Vinci Code movie and the book both pretty fun, if nothing else, was curious about why what your opinion is on that. Some more in-depth answer.
Okay, so there are two principal reasons. The first one is Dan Brown is a deceptive author. As I mentioned when someone else was talking about this last hour, Dan Brown tried to convince his audience that the Da Vinci Code is based on fact. It is not. It is based on a set of ridiculous claims that are not supported by the historical evidence, ridiculous and sensationalist claims that stem from a work known as Holy Blood, Holy Grail by a trio of British authors known as Bagent, Lee, and Lincoln. And it contains material that is contrary to the Christian faith. And Dan Brown took that material and then used it to make a billion, you know, huge amounts of money by convincing people that these items that are contrary to the Christian faith are credible, when in fact they are not. So he is a deceptive author that deceived tons of people. And that's the first reason I don't like him. By the way, I have an episode of Mysterious World on Holy Blood, Holy Grail. So if you go to youtube.com/JimmyAiken and you type in Holy Blood, Holy Grail, you can watch that episode and it'll explain the problems with it. The second reason I don't like him is because he's a terrible prose stylist. He is just awful when you really sit down and study his prose and compare it to competent prose stylists. If you Google the article, Don't Make Fun of Renowned Dan Brown, you'll find it. I actually reposted it on my own website, jimmyaiken.org, so you can read that. That's a parody of his writing style, but when you read it, it gives you a sense of just how terrible Dan Brown's prose is. But if you'd like to see linguists actually tearing it apart, there's a post at a website called Language Log from May 1st, 2004, called the Dan Brown Code. And so just Google Dan Brown Code 2004 Language Log. That'll pop up. And you can read a professional linguist doing a takedown of how horrible Dan Brown's prose style is. Also, if you just Google Dan Brown style mistakes, a bunch of other people chiming in on the problems with him stylistically will also appear.
David, thank you for the question. Man, these lines just will not stop. We've got lots more questions to come. Jimmy Aiken is our guest. It's Ask Me Anything on Catholic Answers Live, and there is more to come right after this. What was the church like in its infancy? In a word, Catholic. And Joe Heschmeyer has the receipts. In his best-selling book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, he gives you the details from the historical records of the first two centuries of Christianity. Right now, get a copy for just $10, plus free shipping if you live in the continental United States. Get more information and order The Early Church Was the Catholic Church at theearlychurchwascatholic.com.
Why We're Catholic is the one book you can hand to anyone to invite them into or back to the Catholic faith. With more than 400,000 copies sold, Trent Horn's book has had a number one ranking on Amazon.com for 5 years running. Now available in softcover, bulk cases, ebook, and on Audible. Find out what the excitement is all about. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic at shop.catholic.com or visit whyweearecatholic.com.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun, and that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that, but he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs, but you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests, he does on-air debates, and he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron.
I'm Deacon Harold Burke Sivers. Join me for Beacon of Truth today at 4 p.m. Eastern.
On the next Beacon of Truth, praying for your enemies in Soulful Psalm 74.
Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Little bit of groovy music for you on a Friday afternoon. I know what you're thinking. Isn't that Thursday afternoon music? But no. Jimmy moved to Friday afternoons, and the groovy music moved with him. Jimmy's here. We've got lots of folks on the line. It's Ask Me Anything today, and we're going next to Perrysburg, Ohio. Perrysburg, Ohio, where Angel is listening on Annunciation Radio. Angel, welcome. Go ahead with your question.
Thank you so much. I wanted to ask, I'm engaged to a person who's high level in the military. And about 2 months into the relationship, I started having episodes where I would literally see and feel a soldier and know his name and be mm-hmm. right in front of me. And I would tell him, and I would say, who's Phoenix? Who's Blair? They're right in front of me and they're talking to me. And he would say, how do you know these things? And he still says it to me. It's still happening. It's happened maybe 15, maybe 20 times. And he's totally shocked because these guys have usually just been killed. Sometimes I've even seen how they've been killed. Why is this happening? I'm just wondering what's happening to me.
Okay, well, the first thing I'd say is, in order to give you a more confident answer, I'd have to ask a whole bunch of questions. I'd need to do an investigation on this. I am able to do that. I'm a certified paranormal investigator. I've taken classes and passed them. And so if you ever want me to, you know, look at this in more detail, you could email me at jimmy@catholic.com. Based on just what you've said, it seems, now, whenever we look at a paranormal experience, that is one that goes beyond what's considered normal in our culture, and this would qualify as paranormal, the first thing to do is try to think through all the possible explanations that could result in the what's being reported. And a lot of those would be natural, and we want to consider the possible natural explanations first, because normal phenomena are more common than paranormal phenomena. Based on what you've said, it, you know, doesn't sound like there are any good normal explanations for this. For example, random chance is not a good explanation for it, because you couldn't randomly guess the names of a whole bunch of people who have just died that your husband knows, your fiance knows. So if things are as you describe, and that's one of the things I'd have further questions about, but if things are as you describe, I would say this sounds like a paranormal event. So the questions then would be, what kind of paranormal event is it? It could, now, these people, if they've just recently died, are speaking to you in what's known as an after-death communication, or ADC. After-death communications are astonishingly common. People tend not to talk about them, but when studies are done, 40 to 50% of people in the general population report having at least one, and sometimes multiple, after-death communications at some point during their lives. And so the question, and they tend to happen shortly after people die. So it could be that these are just after-death communications that normally happen after someone dies. The question would be, why are they happening to you when you weren't the person who knew these individuals, instead of happening to your fiancé? And my first guess answer, if this is all just paranormal, would be because you're more sensitive. You're more open to hearing from these. You may have a greater degree of mental openness to receiving these messages than your fiance does. And so even though they might like to talk to your fiance, he may be closed to them in a way that you're not, and so they talk to you instead. That would at least make sense to me. Now, everything I've just said up to now could happen in terms of natural human causation, where nothing beyond natural human abilities are involved. That would mean that psychic abilities are real. The church has no teaching on whether psychic abilities are real. There have been, as I mentioned last hour, theologians like St. Thomas Aquinas and Pope St. Gregory the Great who believe that they are real. And so just as natural human abilities that God built into human nature. So that could explain what's happening with you. On the other hand, sometimes God takes the initiative and sends, you know, people who, spirits who have died, whether they're saints or in purgatory or whatever else, he allows them to have communication with the living. So it's possible that God also could be responsible for these communications you've been receiving. Hypothetically, it could also be a demon is trying to mess with you. But in the case of a demon, you need evidence that a demon is involved, and you haven't mentioned any. also with God, if God is doing this, then there should be some special purpose behind it. And that would be something that I'd have to dig further into by asking you more questions. And like, so what are these individuals telling you? You know, is there a consistent theme that comes through? But absent any information like that, rather than proposing a demon or proposing God is responsible for this, it sounds like after-death communications to me. And those are very common, and it could be you're getting them because you have a greater talent or a greater degree of openness for receiving them than your fiancé does. But if you'd like a more confident opinion, I'd have to do further investigation, and you can email me at jimmy@catholic.com if that's something you're interested in.
Okay, Angel?
Yes, I would. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
I have one real quick question. One night, I dreamt that he dropped his rifle on my fiancé, fell to the ground, and another man stood in front of him and took the bullet, and another person had a bomb hit him. And, in fact, that's exactly what happened. I woke up at 2 o'clock in the morning, and I was, like, sick all over. And I talked to him, and he said, I told him exactly what happened. He said, how did you know that it's exactly what happened to me? These two men saved my life. And he told me exactly what happened, which was exactly what I saw in my dream. And I woke up really violently sick because I could feel the chest pains and the, you know, the whatever it was they were going through.
So you said you had a real quick question about this?
That's what I was just wondering. Why did I dream that? Why did I know that?
Okay. Okay, gotcha.
Well, it could be an after-death communication. The spirits, to prove, you know, that they're who they say they are, could have given you this dream. After-death communications frequently occur in dreams, and they could have shown you how they saved your fiancé's life as a way of giving you evidence that you could give to your fiancé so that he would have confidence in that's who you're talking to, because only a limited number of people would have known about this experience.
Angel, thank you very much. I hope you will reach out to Jimmy. It's a fascinating story. I'm glad you called. We have full lines. On we go. Hector in Hayward, California, watching on YouTube, is next. Hector, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, thank you for your time.
Well, we're happy to have you, Hector.
My question is, which English Bible translation do you consider is the most accurate to the Greek and Hebrew? And I would like to get your thoughts on the NASB and the ESV, like ignoring Bible commentaries. I know they're not Catholic Bibles, but I have researched them quite a bit, and I own a New American Standard, and I tend to use it as my primary Bible. But I do know they're negatives, but I wonder if these could be more useful for study.
Yeah, so I don't have a Bible that I think is the most accurate to the original languages. There are a wide variety of Bibles that are all quite competent. Now, I tend to have a preference for Bibles that are that use a translation philosophy known as formal equivalence as opposed to dynamic equivalence, especially for study. For study, you want those formal elements in there to preserve aspects of the original languages that can be important. For Bible reading, if all you want to do is read it, you know, like quickly for the sake of comprehending the story, well, then dynamic equivalence translations are fine because they're easier to read. But if you really want to do Bible study, I tend to prefer formal equivalence. But my attitude is, why pick one? You know, there are lots of good ones. I use Bible software, and I've got, you know, a couple, three dozen translations. There are certain ones I tend to go to more than others. I tend to use the Revised Standard Version. I tend to use the English Standard Version, the ESV that you mentioned. Sometimes I'll use the New American Standard Version, or NASB. I also tend to use the Lexham Bible translation. That's a very literal one that's published by Logos Bible Publishers. I tend to use the Young's Literal Translation, which is a hyper-literal translation, or I'll just go to the original languages. But in terms of translations, those are some of the ones I use. If I'm looking for something more on the dynamic end, I often use the New International Version. But there are others, like the New Jerusalem Bible, that are fine, that are dynamic. I'll also, just because it's common in Catholic parishes, I'll often check out what the New American Bible, not the New American Standard Bible, but the New American Bible, or NAB, says. But I don't tend to have it as my go-to for serious Bible study, because it's a little more dynamic than I would like.
Hector, if you're interested, I'd like to send you a copy of Jimmy's book, The Bible is a Catholic Book. It goes into lots of stuff about the Bible, as a matter of fact, and you might enjoy it. And if you'd like it, all you have to do is hang on the line and give us an address. We'll send it out to you. Got to take a quick break. Right back with more Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one. Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Catechism in a Year with me, Father Mike Schmitz, is now available right here on Catholic Radio. Encounter God's plan of sheer goodness for us, revealed in Scripture and passed down through the tradition of the Catholic faith, as we journey together toward our heavenly home.
Bible in a Year and Catechism in a Year with Father Mike Schmitz, tonight at 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific, on EWTN Radio.
Catholic Answers Live, Jimmy Akin, our guest. And a few minutes left and a few calls left, so we'll go back to the phones and let Jimmy answer questions. We'll go to Georgia now. Michelle, listening on 91.1 FM in Georgia. Glad you're here. Michelle, go ahead with your question.
Hello.
Hi, Michelle. You're on the air with Jimmy.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Do you know, or I would like to hear your thoughts on, do our deceased loved ones, can they recall the pain and suffering that they endured while they were with us live?
Well, in order for them not, I mean, humans have memory, and so our memories are not perfect, especially in this life. We can forget things, but we also remember them. And I would say everything else being equal, we would expect our departed loved ones to have the same kind of memories that we do. However, and that would include remembering, you know, pain that they experienced in life. I mean, I can remember pain I've experienced in life. A few weeks ago, a few months ago now, I was trying to step over a barrier and I tripped and I fell face forward and blocked myself with my hands, and especially my right arm hurt like heck after that for some time. And I remember that pain. It doesn't bug me, but I remember, not now, I'm fine now, but it, you know, it's something I remember. And in the same way, if our departed loved ones are with God in heaven, they may well remember the, you know, just like we remember past pain, they may well remember pain too. But if they're with God in heaven, it's not going to bug them. Now, all of that is assuming that they have the same kind of memory they do, but there's reason to think their memories may be better than that. For one thing, they're with God. And so that could at least lead you to speculate that they're going to have even better memories. But we actually have some evidence for this, because one of the things that parapsychology studies is the survival of bodily death, and that includes near-death experiences where people have, for example, clinically died. You know, they've gone into cardiac arrest, and then they continue to have conscious experiences. And one of the things they report is having a lot more information than they had in this life. They will report suddenly knowing stuff. They would just have to think of, oh, I'd like to know about this, and suddenly they know all about it. Well, one of the things that they also report as part of having a lot more information is they have what's called a life review in the literature. A life review is where someone, you know, you've heard this saying about someone's life flashing before their eyes. Essentially, that's what a life review is, where the person has a detailed memory of everything that happened to them in their life and how they acted and how it affected everybody else. So one of the things that people who've had a life review report is suddenly understanding why people did things and have an empathy for them, because in this life you may not know, you know, what another person was dealing with. All you may know is that they hurt you. But in the life review, it's like, oh, now I understand. They were dealing with this other issue, and that's why they acted the way they did. And they come away with a much more empathetic understanding of other people. Well, then in a near-death experience, the person comes back. You know, say the doctors are able to restart their heart. But if near-death experiences are indicative of what happen with deceased people in general, then they would have, you know, this knowledge of everything that happened to them during their life, but it would be framed in this very empathetic understanding way, and that would include any pain they experienced in this life.
Okay, Michelle?
Okay, great, yeah. That gives me great peace.
Good.
Because I find myself asking my mom for forgiveness for her last 2 years that were really hard. And yeah. I'm hoping that she can understand that.
If your
that
mom is with God, or
her as much as you wanted to.
Yeah. If your mom is with God or on her way to God, then she understands, you know, even if you weren't able to care for her the way you wanted, she understands, you know, what you were dealing with and that you were trying. And, you know, you've already asked for forgiveness. If you're a Catholic, you know, you can also go to confession if you think that's needed. But one thing you can be confident of is your mother's love for you, whether she showed it in this life or not. If she's with God or on her way to God, then she loves you and she doesn't want you to beat yourself up about this.
Michelle, thank you. Thank you very much for the call. I'm glad that that gave you some peace. Call back again if more questions come. I'm going to keep moving to try to get to everybody. Yasmin is in Salem, Oregon, listening on the great Modern Day Catholic Radio. Yasmin, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm going to try to formulate my question.
All right.
Good.
We always say that God has a perfect plan for us even before we are born, and he knows us before we are born. My question is, we know a lot of people that get pregnant just to give the babies away for bad things, like sex trafficking and all of that. Why God doesn't prevent that?
Okay.
So since you're asking why bad things happen to people, bad things are evil. In philosophy and in theology, there are two kinds of evil. One is sin, that's moral evil, and the other is suffering. That's physical evil. And they often go together because sin causes suffering. So why would God allow evil in the case of these children? That's a subcase of a more general problem that's known as the problem of evil. Why does a good God allow evil? Whether it's children suffering or children being the victims of sin or both, why would God allow that? Well, this is a big topic. And I've actually, you know, given talks on this, and I think we have a DVD or a talk you can purchase at shop.catholic.com where I go into this in detail. I also believe I have a talk on specifically on the problem of suffering at my YouTube channel, which is youtube.com/Jimmy Akin. So if you go there and you type in, if God is, I think the title is like, if God is real, why do I suffer? And you can watch that for free. But the general answer, just to give you a general answer now, is the Catechism teaches that God would not allow any evil unless he was going to bring about an equal or greater good out of that evil. And so we see an example of this in Jesus dying on the cross. Killing the Son of God, that was a great evil. But out of it, God brought the great good of salvation for the world. And in the same way, when we suffer, whether we're children or adults, God will bring about a great good in the future. We sometimes in this life can figure out what that good is, but in other cases we can't because we have a limited perspective in this life. But we can still be confident. It's kind of like we're in the position of a small child whose parents take the child to the doctor to get an injection so that the child will not get a horrible disease. And the child doesn't know about the horrible disease. All the little child knows is my parents, who were supposed to love and protect me, are letting me be held down by strangers who are sticking a sharp object into my body, and it hurts and it's scary. Well, all that is physical evil. But by letting the child have this physical evil, a greater good will be brought about if the child will not get this horrible disease. The child is not able to understand what the good is, but we as adults can. And in the same way, we as adults may not be able to understand in this life what God's reasons are, but God knows the goods that he is pursuing by allowing evil to happen. So that's a general answer, but if you'd like more, check out either shop.catholic.com.
All right. So, Yasmin, Jimmy was saying, check out shop.catholic.com. Oh, sorry, Jimmy. We you dropped out on us for a second. I apologize.
Or the more specific talk, if God is real, why do I suffer? Which you can get for free at youtube.com/Jimmy Akin.
Yasmin, thank you. Thank you very much. I have to keep going because the more calls. Let's go to Brendan in Houston, Texas, watching on YouTube. Brendan, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hello. Thank you for hearing me.
We're glad to have you, Brendan. But we don't have a lot of time. I apologize for not telling you that. But go right ahead.
Question is real quick. I see the church under attack. I see abortion being pushed. I see so much happening in the culture war and real war, and everybody is asking me to pray for peace. Why shouldn't we be praying for victory?
Well, I don't know who's telling you just pray for peace. I don't think there's anything wrong for praying for victory. I wonder if they may be urging you to pray for peace in particular parts of the world, like, you know, Israel or Ukraine or things like that. And in that case, I would assume that they're trying to be nonpartisan, not supporting one side over another, or not trying to mention a specific way to solve things, but leaving that up to God. You know, what the goal we want to get to is a just peace, but exactly how we get to that goal, human heads may not be able to figure out. So we can leave it to God and just pray for the goal. In the same way, there's nothing wrong with praying for peace. You know, St. Paul talks about how we should pray that we're allowed to leave peaceful and quiet lives. And so praying for peace is a good thing, but praying for victory, you know, at least if we're confident our cause is right, and then praying for victory is a good thing too. And, you know, having the church be victorious in proclaiming the gospel and shaping our culture so that it becomes more in line with the values of Christ, all those things are good, and we can't pray for victory in those cases.
What do you think, Brendan?
Thank you very much.
Oh, well, thank you very much. Thanks for waiting. Jimmy Akin's got a new podcast. This is a tough name to remember. The Jimmy Akin Podcast. You can look for it on YouTube. Wherever you can look for it, wherever you get your podcasts. And it's in addition to Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, the podcast Jimmy's been doing for years now, where there are hundreds of mysteries. These will be mysteries of the faith, Jimmy? Would that be a fair way to talk about it?
The new podcast, the Jimmy Akin Podcast, is devoted to mysteries of the faith, whereas Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World is devoted to mysteries in general.
Check them both out, or just find Jimmy. He's on this podcast. You can see him on Cameron Bertuzzi's podcast. That's pretty regular now that you're on Cameron Bertuzzi's podcast.
Well, Periodically, but it's not one I'm on every week. There are six I'm on every week.
Holy smokes. All right, so listen, if you're listening to a podcast, Jimmy Akin's probably on it. Let's just be honest about that. Jimmy, thanks. I enjoyed the 2 hours. Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
That will do it for us. Don't forget, there's a big sale going on over at shop.catholic.com. 10% off, 20% off, 25%, in some cases more than 25% off. And all, they've got Carlo's new book there. Check out Carlo Broussard's new book, The Saints Pray for You. All on sale right now at shop.catholic.com. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.